Good morning. Welcome to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldine, and this week I have Usha Honeyman, who is a chiropractor and naturopath in Corvallis, who is also has a diplomate from the American College of Chiropractic Internists, which is the chiropractic equivalent of being board certified in internal medicine. And she is a member of ILADS, and we will talk about that. And our topic today is Lyme disease. Welcome, Usha.
Hi.
Okay, so I guess we should talk about what is Lyme disease, and maybe you could talk about why you have an interest in Lyme disease. It's a very obscure problem that most people don't really even know about.
Actually, Lyme disease is a lot less obscure than we think it is, or than most of us think it is. What happened to me was in 2008, I had two patients in the same day come in saying they had Lyme disease, and I said, oh, I don't know very much about this. I think I better go learn. So I contacted ILADS, which is the International Lyme Associated Disease Society, and they have a preceptorship training program for doctors who want to learn to treat Lyme disease. So I went through that and started treating patients. Do you want me to explain what Lyme disease is?
Yes.
Okay. Lyme disease is a bacterial infection. Actually, the term Lyme disease is an umbrella term for a variety of infectious diseases people get from the bite, usually of a tick, but there are other biting insects, mosquitoes, and biting flies can transmit these bacteria, but the tick is specially adapted to disable our immune system at the site of the bite, which causes the infection to be more likely to be transmitted to the mammal, in this case humans.
So other mammals obviously get tick bites. People have seen their dogs have ticks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually veterinarians do screen cats and dogs for Lyme disease, and they, for example, here in Benton County, I've had my veterinarian, because I have dogs, has told me that there is a lot of Lyme disease in dogs and cats in Benton County. And companion animals like that do get treated for Lyme disease. So yes, we have Lyme disease in Oregon.
Is it transmittable from your dog to yourself?
No, it's transmitted by insects that take a blood meal and then go bite another animal or mammal. So the main reservoir, I believe, is the white-footed mouse, but it goes by ticks from the white-footed mouse to deer. So wherever deer are prevalent, we're going to see more Lyme disease because the deer transport it.
The deer are rampant in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, not just in Oregon.
Yeah. Yeah, the deer population, if you look at the demographics of deer, the deer population started mushrooming, I believe, in the 1930s in North America. And so Lyme has traveled throughout the continent with the deer.
Hmm. Now, but you can't get sick from eating a deer with Lyme, right?
Well, that's a question. If the meat is well cooked, correct, you cannot. And it's not transmitted very well through the gastrointestinal tract, or at all, as far as I know. So probably that would be a true statement.
Okay.
There's a lot about this bacteria that we don't know.
Okay. So now this bug has a very particular shape that's a lot like the shape of syphilis, that organism.
Yeah, so Lyme disease is an umbrella term for this group of infections that we know can be transmitted by ticks. The Lyme bacteria is named Borrelia burgdorferi, and it is a spirochete. Spirochetes have a spiral shape. So in essence, the way they travel through tissue is it's like a corkscrew. They burrow, and the most similar disease that humans get infected with is the sexually transmitted disease, syphilis. So syphilis is also a spirochete, and it also burrows through tissue. So the Lyme spirochete can travel pretty much anywhere in the body and affect any organ or tissue because of its ability to burrow.
So it could go then through your skin. So you get it in your arm, and it could go into your blood and
mm-hmm,
then travel
exactly.
through your blood and then end up wherever it wanted?
Yes. Yeah, the most serious manifestation is if it sets up housekeeping in the brain and or spinal cord.
Oh. So let's talk about the symptoms then. How would one know? Let's say you had a tick bite,
mm-hmm.
and you knew you had a tick bite. And then we can talk about if you didn't know you had a tick bite.
Okay. So if you knew you had a tick bite, and you got a rash at the site of the bite, and if you look online, people talk about the target rash and the EM, or stands for erythema migrans rash.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that the erythema migrans rash or target rash has a variety of appearances, so it's not just the target where it clears in the center. It can be a solid blotch. It doesn't have to be round or oval. I've seen trapezoidal shaped EM rashes on patients.
So any kind of a rash around the bite.
Mm-hmm, around the bite, and it usually lasts for more than a couple of days. The rash will, it usually doesn't itch, so it's just this, and if people don't realize what it is, they don't take it very seriously because it doesn't bother them at
mm-hmm.
the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that that only 50%, so CDC has done studies, and only 50% of the people where they can actually isolate the organism from their body tissues by biopsy and then culture the organism in the lab, only half of those people ever got a rash.
Mm-hmm.
So
even a rash, but if you do have a rash, it's pretty suggestive that you have it, right?
If you have a rash, that basically if you have a known tick bite with a rash, that meets the Centers for Disease Control criteria for diagnosing Lyme disease without any lab tests.
Okay.
And because Lyme disease it can be this long-term smoldering infection with very serious repercussions if it goes untreated, it's really important to treat it early, because if it's treated early, people get better.
Okay, so before we go into that, let's talk about the person who has a bite and doesn't know they have a bite.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Maybe they didn't get a rash, or maybe it was in a place that they couldn't see, like maybe on their, low back, somewhere where you can't notice it.
Mm-hmm. So the other symptoms of early Lyme, people can have flu-like symptoms. They often have a low-grade fever or fluctuating fever and sweats. Joint pains can be either an early or a late symptom of Lyme, so, arthritic-type joint pains,
mm-hmm.
and body aches.
Well,
also,
great. So, especially if that happens in the winter, that could be mistaken for,
mm-hmm.
flu.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. So that would be really easy to think that that was something that would be self-limiting and no big deal.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And ticks, I'd like to talk a little bit about ticks.
Okay.
They like moist environments, which we definitely have.
And we have more than you do over the Coast
right.
Mountains.
Yeah, they need, and they, so... We in Oregon, we could have tick activity throughout, especially on the Coast Range. You guys could have it throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
They need humidity to survive. They also need some woody, brushy, shady, grassy areas, which you guys definitely have.
Mm-hmm.
They don't fly or jump. They're drawn to warmth, movement, and carbon dioxide. They tend to wait on the edges of leaves or tips of grass for a host to approach. So in the Willamette Valley, when everything gets really dry in the summertime, then we probably don't have too much trouble with ticks in the dry areas. But you guys have moisture year-round there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do actually have a drought time, usually. Last summer we didn't. But usually from July to the end of September, it's pretty dry. So that would be a lower tick time.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Where do they go?
I don't know. Well, I think they go into crevices of debris, like woody debris.
Mm-hmm.
I think they hibernate in there, but I'm not an entomologist.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would make sense. they're going to go to a wet place and kind of hang out till they can get some more to eat.
Yeah, and then the other issue that patients always ask me is about tick attachment. So the thing that ticks need to be attached for 24 hours before they can transmit Lyme is actually a myth. They have documented cases of two of the co-infections. I know it's Babesia, and I think the other one is Anaplasma, being transmitted in 2 hours of tick attachment.
Uh-huh. Okay, so what if a person has a tick, and they see it, what how? You sound like you should get it off immediately, and how should you do that?
Well, in Corvallis, my veterinarian dispenses for dogs. We'll get into the controversy a little bit later, but the animals get better Lyme awareness than human beings do, unfortunately. But the device that my veterinarian dispenses for free, it's like a little miniature melon scooper, only it's tiny and it has a little slit in it, and so you don't want to burn the back of the tick to get it off, because that may make the head burrow in more. You don't want to squeeze the tick. You want to use something that's made for removing ticks, and so when you've been out, it's good to do a tick check when you come inside and use something that's appropriate that won't squish the tick or make it burrow in to remove it. So I've heard people say you unscrew them. That doesn't work. You want to use a device that's made for removing ticks. Tweezers are okay.
So do you just pull straight out then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just pull straight out without squeezing it.
So you want to hold with the tweezers as close to the point where they're in you as possible?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think the best appliance is this little... Like I said, it's a miniature melon baller with a little slit in it that you pry the tick out with.
Mm. So people can get that from a vet?
That's where my veterinarian in Corvallis has them. So yes, I believe you probably can.
That seems like something ought to be available at, I don't know.
Primary care healthcare?
Or pharmacies? Or
yeah.
Or maybe it's something that everyone, ought to have in their...
First aid kit.
Something like that. Okay, so then when you get it out, do you throw it away or do you save it to go to have it tested to see if it has Lyme?
Well, I've heard stories locally here that happens. People take the tick out and they put it in a little baggie or an envelope or something and take it to the doctor. And because most physicians in this area aren't aware that we have Lyme around here, they don't get the tick tested. But you can, but on the East Coast, where there's a lot more Lyme, doctors will either just treat the patient immediately or send the tick to get tested.
Mm-hmm. I know OSU can, Oregon State University, their entomology lab will test it if you send it there.
Okay, and there's a lab in California, in Palo Alto. You can find them on the web. It's Igenex, Igenex. So you can look them on the web, and you can individual people who aren't physicians can send ticks there to get tested. Mm-hmm. Also,
well, and the good thing would be if you had your tick tested and it was negative, then you're done. You don't have to worry about it.
Yes.
You don't have to go through treatment. You don't have to do anything.
Right. That's if you knew you had a tick bite.
Right. Well, I'm talking about if we have a tick.
Yeah. Yes.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more. We're back. You're listening to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldine, and I'm with Dr. Usha Honeyman, who is a chiropractor and naturopathic physician in Corvallis. When we stopped, we were talking about a person who got bit by a tick, knew they got bit by a tick, and either tested it or not. How about a person who feels crummy and continues to feel crummy and goes to the doctor and says, I have some of these symptoms, flu, fever, joint pain, body aches, I haven't felt well for a couple of months?
That gets a little more tricky, and that gets us into some of the political controversy around Lyme. I do want to give the listeners a sense of the prevalence of the disease.
Oh, good.
The Centers for Disease Control, if you look on their website, they report that they have 27 new cases reported annually that meet the CDC surveillance criteria, but they estimate that Lyme disease is underreported by tenfold. So that means in the United States, we're getting about 200,000 new cases of Lyme disease every year. So this is the most prevalent insect-borne disease in North America, way more prevalent than what's that West Nile fever that they made the big fuss about. So this is actually a really common disease because if you think about it, we're getting 200,000 new cases a year, but then we're getting the case that you just talked about where people go undiagnosed, and I've got patients in my practice who've been had this infection and haven't been diagnosed for 10, 20, in some cases even 30 years that they still have the infection.
So how is it that people escape getting a diagnosis of this problem?
I think there's many factors involved. The main one in Oregon is that we
don't think we have it.
Right, we don't think we have it, so the mechanism for reporting it, the mechanisms aren't in place, so doctors aren't made aware. Because we don't think we have it, the public health department doesn't tell physicians they need to look for it. And then the biggest issue is the diagnostic criteria, because if there's a lot we've learned about the bacteria. The bacteria was first discovered in 1982, and the controversy around Lyme disease and its treatment has been going on in medicine since the late 1970s. So because there's this huge political controversy in medicine about Lyme disease, the one side says this is easy to diagnose and easy to treat, and the other side says it's hard to diagnose and hard to treat. So
that's a bit of a disconnect.
Yeah,
it's absolutely the opposite.
Right, and the trouble is really for patients is they get caught in the middle. So for the patient you described who's going in saying, you know, I don't feel well, I haven't felt well for a long time, I have all these strange symptoms, a lot of times when people come to me, they've been told by other doctors that they need an antidepressant.
Mm-hmm. Or they have fibromyalgia or something else.
Right, yeah. So the conditions that Lyme commonly gets misdiagnosed as rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. I just had a Lyme patient a couple of years ago was diagnosed with ALS, which she did have because she'd had Lyme for so long, but she was a case where her Lyme disease had been missed for 20, 25 years, and she passed away without ever getting treated for Lyme because of that disconnect in medicine where the neurologist never tested her for Lyme.
Okay, so we better talk about testing. What is appropriate testing?
The CDC has a two-tier set of tests. So doctors who don't understand about the biology of the infection will go with an ELISA screening test. And more than half the patients who have Lyme, when they look at the validity of this test, more than half the patients with confirmed bacteria fail this screening test. But for primary care doctors who don't deal with Lyme, they run this screening test, and if it's negative, then they tell the patient they don't have Lyme. And I get those cases all the time where I look and I say, well, but you're running antibodies. You just weren't running enough antibodies to flag this test positive. And the interesting thing for patients is that women tend to get sicker with Lyme and they don't mount an antibody response. So if you use an antibody test as your screen, you miss more than half of the women with Lyme disease. The next test, which regular doctors who aren't Lyme literate wouldn't even run, is a Western blot IgG and IgM for Lyme. Now that test, some of the critical markers are left off the test, and there's only two labs in the country that will run those critical antibodies because they, in order to do it, they have to actually grow up the bacteria in-house. So they're specialty labs for testing Lyme. I don't know if this is too much detail.
Mm-mm.
Okay. So it gets really difficult to get a diagnosis unless a patient's going to a physician who understands the nuances of the bacteria itself and the proper testing.
Okay, so it wouldn't be a tissue biopsy. It would be blood.
Yes, it's a blood test. The tissue biopsy, that's an interesting thing you raise. Even if people have an EM rash, because I've checked into it in this area for like Eugene, Corvallis area, mm-hmm. The bacteria is really unique. This Lyme spirochete has three times the number of genes that the next most complicated bacteria that infects human beings has. So this bacteria can turn on and off a variety of genes in order to evade immune detection and to survive in the body. And because it's so complicated, it is very difficult to culture it in the lab. You need a special, it's called BSK media. So when I called the labs in Eugene and Corvallis, they said, well, we don't have that media. There's no way we're going to culture for that bacteria. Mm-hmm. So basically in Oregon, if you wanted to get a culture for this bacteria, you probably would have to contact the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia yourself.
Oh, great. Well, most patients aren't going to do that.
Right, and even for me as a physician, that's kind of above and beyond what I can practically do.
But the second antibody test you send off to a lab not in Oregon?
I send that one to that Igenix in Palo Alto, uh-huh. California. Because the reason being, the outer surface proteins, and this also gets into politics somewhat, there are several outer surface proteins of the Borrelia burgdorferi, the Lyme spirochete, that can be tested for. But because there was a vaccine on the market for 2 years, I believe it was 1998 and 1999, and it was pulled because of serious health problems caused by the vaccine, but the vaccine used two of the four known outer surface proteins. So the FDA said those two outer surface proteins cannot be included in a test kit that's sold on the market. So if I want to send a test to the hospital lab in Corvallis, the test kit that they have eliminates two of the four outer surface proteins from their panel. So if I want to get all the available outer surface proteins of Borrelia tested, I have to send the sample to either this lab in California or there's a lab in New Jersey that will test all of them.
That is insane.
Mm-hmm. Yes, especially because, again, going back to the sickest patients with Lyme disease are women, and because of our female hormones, women don't mount as good an antibody response. So if I'm testing a female patient, I always want to be able to send the test to a lab that's going to test all of the available proteins.
Wow. Okay, so the average time that it takes to get a diagnosis with Lyme is many years, correct?
I don't know the statistics on that for sure, but it can be, yes, especially in Oregon. So the fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome actually are diagnoses that came into the medical texts in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And if you look back at the history of Lyme disease, those are patients with chronic untreated Lyme disease.
You think across the board?
I would say by far the majority, yeah. And the because initially, so going back to the late 1970s, early 1980s, the group charged with studying this was a rheumatology group because they had acute juvenile, several cases of children in the same neighborhood that had arthritis. So this astute mother named Polly Murray in Lyme, Connecticut, called the health department and said, something's going on here. So because it was arthritis, rheumatologists were put on the scene, and they decided it must be viral, just looking at it initially. And then in 1982, when the bacteria was discovered, that kind of turned it on its ear. But we still are living with this legacy of it's a any symptoms patients have after 3 to 4 weeks of antibiotic treatment are inflammatory, not the infection. So that's what is in the IDSA, the International Disease Society of America, the infectious disease doctors. That's their treatment guidelines. Now, I'm certain that not all members of the IDSA agree with that, but that's their official policy. And if I'm not a Lyme literate doctor, that's the information I'm going to get if I just look on my handheld computer about diagnosing and treating Lyme disease.
Okay, so if a patient has symptoms after that 4 to 6 weeks and they've been treated with antibiotics, you're saying you would disagree with that. They still have an active infection.
Right, and so here's the example I use for my patients, and I just made this up. I want to say it's not in the scientific literature. But if I have pneumonia and I want to treat that the bacteria that cause pneumonia replicate 3 times an hour. So if I am on 10 days of antibiotics, that's 720 bacterial replications, and antibiotics kill bacteria when they're replicating. The all of these tick-borne infections, so it's not just the Borrelia burgdorferi, but also people could get Bartonella or Ehrlichia or Babesia along with this, or probably several other bacteria. And these tick-borne bacteria reproduce about once a day. So if I want to cover 720 replications of the Lyme disease bacterial types, that means basically 720 days of antibiotic to get the same coverage for the replicative cycles as I got for my example of pneumonia.
Oh, well, 720, that's 2 years.
Right, that's 2 years. Now, as I tell my patients, no physician in their right mind would write a prescription for 2 years of antibiotics, but we know a lot more about the biology of this bacteria now than was known in 1982 when it was discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my practice, the antibiotics are a tool to create some dead bacteria because these bacteria hide from immune detection. They hide from immune detection really well. And so we want to create some dead bacteria with the antibiotic to help the immune system mobilize.
So how do you know what antibiotic to use?
That gets a little complicated. The Lyme bacteria doesn't seem to have become antibiotic resistant, and I think that's because it replicates so slowly. So when people first get infected, it's in the spirochete form. And so we use a cell wall antibiotic, so that would be something like a cephalosporin or a penicillin.
Mm-hmm.
But about 2 to 3 months after infection, some of the spirochetes shed their cell wall and go inside of our cells. So the antibiotics we use for the cell wall form, the spirochete form, don't get inside of our cells. So then you need another antibiotic, usually a tetracycline or a macrolide, to go get the intracellular form of the Lyme. And again, if people get treated within that first couple of months, then you're just treating the spirochete form and you don't have to worry about using a second drug.
And so then do you think you're done? You're done? You mean,
yes.
You're cured?
Finished. That's the thing. If people get treated early on in the disease, then they're done. Because if you get the spirochete when you only have the cell wall form and you use the antibiotic before it has a chance to adapt to its new environment, then you're basically the patient is done.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is some controversy about whether antibiotics should be long-term or short-term, but you've certainly laid out the case for the long-term because of the trickiness or the delay in treatment. We don't really have time to go into more of it, but if you want to just do a wrap-up, that would be great.
There's so much to say about Lyme disease. The thing that I would plead with patients is, if you don't feel well, and you're not getting answers and you suspect Lyme disease, just find another doctor. There are Lyme-literate physicians in Oregon. There's not very many of us. I have a symptom checklist on my website, which is www.ushahoneyman.com, and I just tell my patients, if you've got more than 10 of those symptoms, it's highly suspicious for Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm.
And patients with 20 of those 38 symptoms, I just go ahead and treat them before their labs come back.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you very much. My guest has been Dr. Usha Honeyman. She is a chiropractor and naturopathic physician and chiropractic internist in Corvallis, and you have been listening to Your Health. Thanks a lot, Usha.
Thank you very much.